This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, chapters 19 and 20, The Hungarian Horntail and the First Task. In these chapters, dragons... Dragons. And I love it.
Yeah, this is where they come back. So I think I had asked, you said they showed up again. So they're definitely a presence in these two chapters.
Exactly. So overall, preliminary thoughts, what were your impressions of seeing dragons again?
I think one of my big questions in this world so far is the relationship with the wizards and dragons, because they wear them, they respect them in a sense, they're, part of their game. Just very interesting relationship with these creatures. So also a little bit of moral questions with how we play the Triwizard Tournament. The fact that cheating's acceptable was interesting to me. But overall, and we got a little Quidditch. I know they canceled Quidditch, but it was Quidditch-like there for a little bit. So
Quidditch-esque?
Quidditch-esque, yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty then. Well, we start with chapter 19, and Harry's just talking about the prospect of talking face-to-face with Sirius was all that sustained him over the next fortnight, the only bright spot on a horizon that had never looked darker.
Yeah, because he's going through it right now. He's got this, impending championship task that he doesn't know what it is quite yet. And then Ron and him are still having a bit of a falling out. And then there's this whole being quoted in the news with false quotes.
Yes. So if things could not get worse about Harry's social life in the castle, just on general principle on what has happened, Rita Skeeter has published this sensational article. Again, she was supposed to talk about the Triwizard Tournament, but it was basically a whole expo on Harry. And again, saying things that he did not say at all. I wonder how many libel cases have been waged against Rita Skeeter?
That's a great question. Yeah, she definitely makes it, the last thing I think we've learned about Harry Potter is he's very much front and center, no matter how hard he tries not to be. And she pushed him out there on the front page, kind of not really in the position he wants to be. And then he has to deal with, like you said, with the liable things that he's crying at night because he misses his parents and saying all these little over the top things and then having kids quote it back to him, which is, Rita made bad decisions.
Yeah, I never really, to the same extent that I am now in previous readings, I never really much connected Rita Skeeter with Lockhart in this way, because, she's the reporter and Lockhart was another celebrity, but both are similar in the sense of wanting to force Harry into the spotlight, both in different ways, but each for the reason of bolstering themselves.
Right. Exactly. She's definitely this is my vehicle, but it sounds like Rita was relatively established. I don't think she's going for a Pulitzer. She just wants to keep her name out there, I guess.
She's what do they call it? Danielle Steele.
Oh, okay. All right.
Have you read any of her books?
I have not.
Neither have I. And, like, she barely sleeps. She's written so much books, and it's, you know, the amount of the lack of critical acclaim for how many books she's written. You know, again, I can't judge her writing. I've never read a book. I'm just saying this, you know, Rita Skeeter comes off as that, you know, not looking for critical acclaim in terms of hardcore legitimate journalism, just wants to, you know, make the easiest buck.
You know, power to her if she's successful. I don't know. At this point in my adult life, working life, I'm like, do what you gotta do to make your life easy. I don't know, to some extent.
Well, yeah. Even if I do sympathize with Rita on that point, she can do it against adults like Dumbledore. Like, don't do it against kids.
That is very true. Yes, I don't know the little I know about Danielle Steele. I don't know if she is slandered a child's name. I hope not. But
no, I know. And, you know, so Harry's hearing this nonstop back and forth, and someone calls Harry's name, and he's like, yeah, that's right. I've just been crying my eyes out over my dead mom, and I'm just off to do some more. And I'm like, no, it was just, you dropped your quill. It was Cho.
I feel like I've been in this situation where I take something out on somebody, and I'm like, oh, whoops, that really wasn't meant for you. So poor Harry, and here he is noticing Cho Chang again, so.
Mm-hmm. And she's like, good luck on the task. I really hope you do well. And which left Harry feeling extremely stupid.
And yeah, I was going to say, he doesn't notice this about her yet, but he's a little emotionally fried, I would say, at this point.
He is. And Hermione is also getting her fair share of crap from the article because Rita Skeeter mentions her, and Pansy Parkinson is like, stunningly pretty, her. What was she judging against? A chipmunk? So this just raises the question of, you know, with the nature of, you know, it's written in the books that her hair is really bushy, that her front teeth are really big. And, you know, a lot of people interpret that as, you know, Hermione is very plain, if not flat out ugly, and that the casting of her, you know, like in a lot of media, like they beautified her when it's not present in the books. Which, again, I think, you know, I never really thought about it. I just thought about my bushy, like, brownish, ash blonde hair. And my front teeth are actually quite large, if you think about it. And I do have an overbite, but I've never perceived that as being, like, looking, like, bad or like a beaver, like, to not that extent. So I guess what I'm getting at is, in the book, I never perceived Hermione as being, like, super ugly. I always perceived it more as she's so infuriating in her personality, and that's what gets her a bad reputation, not so much that she's flat-out ugly.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess I'm reading these books with the kind of very much picturing the absolutely stunning Emma Watson in my head. So, but as she's described, and if I'm separating that, I just kind of thought of her as somebody who's not really probably standing in front of a mirror brushing her hair out for like 20 or 40 minutes every morning. She's got stuff to do. She wants to go to the library. She wants to read. Like, those aren't important things. Because in this article, Rita Skeeter is basically saying that she's Harry's girlfriend. And I do appreciate the fact that they don't get all grossed out and weird about it. It's just kind of like, that's stupid. And then they seem to move on. So
yeah, and I think, and it's, and in a way, bolstering Harry in the sense that Harry has the best girl in the year and the smartest girl in the year as his girlfriend. So anyway, it's just an interesting notion because it does happen in media, like very definitely in a Game of Thrones. Like Tyrion in the books is way uglier than Peter Dinklage, you know, who plays him on the TV show. So that there is some basis, and it does happen in media. I'm not saying it doesn't. I just never thought of it as being, or maybe that's my own defense mechanism because I was compared to Hermione as a kid. And so maybe I'm just subconsciously trying to avoid the, was I ugly? I don't think I was that ugly.
I think kids are cruel. I don't think that applies to you at all. And I, you know, that's, I don't know. It is interesting. I mean, you know, people like to look at, pretty people. I just kept thinking about Hermione and thinking of Emma Watson's portrayal. And it's like, nobody really knew she was going to turn out to be as cute as she is. I don't know. Whatever. I'm a fan of her. So
yeah. And honestly, now moving forward, I definitely perceive reading Hermione. I perceive her much more darker and like blacker now.
Mm, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
That was, I know that's been a little bit of the controversy, and I mean, controversy in, I don't know whose mind, but of debate, I would say, of her like depiction. And I say that maybe she's a little loosely talked about because, you know, I don't know. I'm doing a little gymnastics here. As a reader, you can kind of insert yourself in that a little bit, maybe.
Yep. And so Hermione's trying to get Harry and Ron to talk to each other. And Harry's like, I didn't start this. It's his problem. You miss him. And I know he misses you. Miss him, said Harry. I don't miss him. Which, you know, I understand Hermione's point, but I don't think Hermione should be trying to push a reconciliation at this point. And quite frankly, I think, yeah, at the end of the day, Hermione should definitely be taking Harry's side more, because yes, she's sympathetic to Ron's like insecurities and stuff, but Harry needs to survive this Triwizard Tournament. Like, Harry's concerns take precedent over Ron's insecurities right now.
Yeah, it is. People don't like to be pushed. So I guess Hermione probably should take a moment and think, like, maybe if I just let it be, that might be better. And you're right, supporting Harry and his impending possible demise here.
Yeah, and it's also, again, we sympathize with Ron because of his insecurities, but it is a really shitty thing for Ron to do that Harry's been thrust into this situation and he can't get out of it. And so he's dealing with all that. And on top of that, one of his, some really, really close to him basically said, you wanted this. Like, that is some severe mind fuckery.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's, I wonder how Ron would handle it in a different situation. But right now he's kind of on his own, and good that he has Hermione there to kind of help him through. She could very easily kind of shun one or the other, and that would isolate somebody else even more, and that would be bad. So good on Hermione's emotional intelligence.
Yep, and Victor Krum was in the library an awful lot too, and Harry wondered what he was up to. Was he studying, or was he looking for things to help him through the first task? Hermione often complained about Krum being there, not that he ever bothered them, but because of groups of giggling girls often turn up to spy on him. He's not even good looking, she muttered angrily. So, you know a little bit of what's coming, you know. And so, you know, I always took with this Victor Krum, like, for all of his, like, Quidditch stuff, I, in my headcanon, like, Victor Krum is actually really, really smart.
Okay.
I have it in my head that he has Quidditch and he's passionate about Quidditch, but also in my headcanon, I'm just like, he has another side of him that is like doing like advanced transfiguration and like alchemy and like creating another sorcerer's stone.
I think that could track. I mean, it's athleticism and, you know, the phrase dumb jock or whatever that's often equated, and I've known several athletic people who that does not apply to in the slightest. So I like that. I think that's and it's obvious they're alluding to something going on between Hermione and Krum. And Hermione, I see you, because I don't know how many people I've been like, they're not even that good looking, only to find them like very good looking a month later. So I see through you, Hermione.
Yep. And so the Saturday before the first task is a Hogsmeade weekend.
Yeah. And then Harry goes about this. He's so like up in his emotions too about all the hullabaloo around this article and then the whatever nonsense with Ron that he decides that he wants to go, but he wants to wear the invisibility cloak to go to on this outing.
Yeah, literally just to get a break from all the jeering.
Right, right. Which I can't blame him. No. Shoot, I'd use that thing like crazy if I had it.
Yeah, it's it's just sad that Harry has been pushed to that point, that not even the distance of, like, the castle or going into the village is enough for him. He literally doesn't want to be seen by, like, anybody.
Yeah, I'm hoping, I guess, I was hoping that would change in the first task, and of course it does. But
yeah. And so they go into the village, and it's like, people keep looking at me now, said Hermione grumpily. Don't move your lips so much. Come on, please just take off your cloak. No one's going to bother you. Oh yeah, look behind you, and here comes Regis Skeeter just bursting by.
Of course. So this is when you're kind of like Harry, you're kind of a ding-dong. It's kind of like, oh, he's justified in his, you know, his camouflage here. But I can understand Hermione looks like she's basically talking to herself. And again, at this age, everybody's pretty self-conscious anyway.
Yep. And so they totter on into the Three Broomsticks, which I wish we were having our virtual Halloween party there with the butterbeer. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, that would be nice. I would like to try a butterbeer.
Yep. Yeah, so they head in there, and Harry sees Ron, and he's basically, Ron is sort of taking sanctuary with Fred and George, and by extension, the twins' friend, Lee Jordan. And then, resisting the urge to give Ron a good hard poke in the back, he finally reached the table and sat down at it.
I thought this was pretty silly of Harry, because I was like, Harry, Ron would know who that was. Like, come on, man. You all have horsed around in the invisibility cloak too often. But Hermione is, like, also thinking about this as an opportunity to get some of the villagers into spew. Like, she's really ready to go public with this.
Mm-hmm. And what does Harry say? Like, you know, when house elves, like, I wonder how you get into the school kitchens. No idea. Ask Fred and George, said Harry. And Hermione's like, I may just do that.
Yeah, she's cooking up something. I think it's, we just don't know all about it quite yet.
Yep. And Harry is left to sip his butterbeer under his cloak, looking around at everyone so happy and gallivanting and carrying on in Three Broomsticks, and he's thinking of his own fan fiction of, what if my name hadn't been put in the Goblet of Fire and I would just be sitting here, no cloak, with Ron and Hermione, happily predicting, like, what sort of dangerous things the champions would be doing.
This was, I could again relate to Harry here. It's like, well, what if this didn't happen, and then just kind of spinning out on that fantasy. But yeah, and then they bump into, well, they, Hermione, bumps into Hagrid and Professor Moody, and Moody's eye has a lot of cool functionality, including being able to see through invisibility cloaks. So
yeah, so the eye can see through the back of his head. It can see through, like, solid objects like walls and furniture, and it can see through invisibility cloaks.
That is a magical eye. So
I'm just wondering, I've never really thought that deeply about it, but who was the guy or woman or girl who created that eye for him?
That's a good, I wonder if it has any, like, relation to, I don't know.
I just thought about it because, again, you have yet to read A Court of Thorns and Roses. I hope you will at some point, maybe even do a podcast with me later in years' time. But there is a character who has a sort of, like, metal, like, sort of eye that has replaced his real eye. And I don't think it has the same extensive features that Moody does, but it just made me think of, and, like, you do end up meeting the person who did create that eye for that character later on in the books. And so, yeah, so you finally met the creator, and I'm just like, I wish we met the eye creator.
Yeah, that had to be some pretty powerful magic to create that eye. And because, I mean, invisibility cloaks are known about, right? Like, that's something people know about, but
they're rare, but they are known about.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Well, so basically they go over, kind of like mosey over to Hermione and kind of pretend to be very interested in this spew notebook, when in actuality they're wanting to kind of talk to Harry a little bit.
Yeah. And so it's very clear that Moody has told Hagrid that Harry is there, and Hagrid's like, hey, you know, come down to me hut. I got something to show you. And he's like, and then doesn't even give Harry a chance to respond. He's just like, bye, Hermione. And then they leave.
Right. Yeah. They, you knew somebody was going to help Harry out here a little bit.
Yeah, but also, you know, I can understand Harry's dread because it's usually never anything good when Hagrid needs you to meet at his hut at night after curfew. You know something bad is happening.
Right, especially when he's like, we don't want anybody else to know that you're there. Like, as I think he says, bring your visibility and, you know, your cloak with you or something. So
yeah, and yeah. Harry's really both anxious about it for that, and then also anxious, like, I have to meet Sirius in the tower at 1 a.m. How am I going to do both of these?
Right, he feels like me on a busy meeting day. He's like, oh my yeah. God, how am I going to manage this?
Yeah, no, that's me trying to get through my staff meeting because I have a scholarly slither clause with Nat in the library.
That's, hey, that's the important thing.
So. Gotta have your priorities straight, man.
Right, exactly.
So, basically, Harry's just like, okay, I'm just gonna have to, you know, hightail it, you know, back, you know, if the Hagrid thing drags out. And so, Harry gets there, and it's not, Hagrid doesn't just take Harry, he also takes Madame Maxime. And at first, Harry's like, why is Hagrid bringing me in to crash on his date with Madame Maxime?
right. A little awkward, but yeah.
But he very quickly puts two and two together that Madame Maxime is also going to be someone who's surprised, who Hagrid is showing her the exact same thing. And what right. does it end up being?
It even says it in italics, or italics, dragons.
Four fully grown, enormous, vicious-looking dragons were rearing on their hind legs inside an enclosed fence with thick planks of wood roaring and snorting.
Yeah, and they go into some detail about the way that they look, some kind of like variety of dragons. We don't have like a uniform dragon here. They're kind of all kinds of different colors and...
Yep, all sorts of different breeds and shapes and sizes and... They're so large and magically powerful, as Sirius said, that it takes like over half a dozen, like a dozen wizards to simultaneously cast the stunning spell for it to knock the dragon out cold.
Right, yeah. So why are we bringing these to children? Who the hell knows? But, you know, whatever.
I don't know. Not to dismiss Harry's, you know, trepidation, but I'm thinking like if... A dragon should be easier for Harry than it was with the basilisk when he was 12.
That's true. That's very true. Very scary, and these guys have wings, so that's
they a factor. Fire, but at least he can look at them.
That is true as well. Well, Charlie's there, so that's exciting. So we have some Weasley friends there.
Yeah, Weasley cameos. And Charlie's basically saying, you know, there's a common Welsh green, the smaller one, a Swedish snort snout, that blue-gray, and the Chinese fireball, that's the red, and then the big black one is the Hungarian horntail, which it's black. I never perceived it in my headcanon as being black. I just remember that Norbert was black, but Norbert was a Norwegian ridgeback.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I just, of course, the big scary one, you know that Harry's going to be dealing with that one. It's just the way it goes. But
yeah. And Charlie explains that, you know, they wanted specifically nesting mothers who are obviously the most aggressive and like has, and Hagrid sees all the eggs and Charlie's like, I have them counted, Hagrid.
That's, yeah. Oh my gosh. Sternly. He says it sternly. Yeah, because we also know what happens when Hagrid is around some dragon eggs. So.
Yeah, it doesn't really. Oh, and one thing I noticed, like, you know, what they make mention of, like, three-headed, like, Hagrid's escapades with, like, spiders and three-headed dogs. And that just made me think of, what happened to Fluffy?
That's a good question.
Where does Fluffy live? Does he live in the Forbidden Forest?
I have not thought about that, but now that you say that. Maybe he just gets to roam free. I don't know.
But I thought that was interesting that Fluffy just magically appeared to be like the guardian of the Sorcerer's Stone and now poof, he's gone.
I don't know. That's interesting.
So basically Hagrid's like, you know, do they have to, like, fight them directly? And Charlie's like, no, they just gotta get past them. And so Harry gets the gist of it and finally realizes, oh shit, I'm cutting it close, and is scampering back to the palace. But before he makes it all the way there, he bumps into a mysterious figure in the middle of the night, Karkaroff.
Yeah, who now, of course, is on my radar because I was thinking about our conversation and you're like, you know, what asked what I thought about him. And I was like, not much. But now I kind of, he's on my radar. So
literally Harry just plowed into him, and luckily Karkaroff like just assumes he bumped into like an animal or something, and then finally he goes down to like the woods to also get a look at the dragons, most likely. And so it's like, okay, now me and then probably Fleur and probably Crumb are going to figure out where about the dragons via their headmasters. So right. Harry runs back up and finally gets to the Gryffindor Tower. It doesn't smell like dumb bongs. Hermione did not have to take that drastic of measures to clear out the common room.
Thank goodness for that. And he gets there to see Sirius's head was sitting in the fire.
Yeah.
So,
and making note that if he had not seen Amos Diggory do this at the Burrow in the exact same way, he just would have like completely freaked out.
Yes, I'm glad he thought about that, because that's exactly what would have happened. So Harry kind of gives him the rundown of what's been going on.
Yeah, and Harry makes note to mention that Sirius, despite being on the run, is a lot healthier. Like, his hair is like neat and tidy. His face is fuller. He's no longer as sunken and sallow and like skull-like. I like to think with all those tropical birds that he was just chilling out incognito in some sort of Caribbean resort.
That sounds delightful. I'd like to be doing that as well.
And so, yep.
Oh, go ahead.
No, just Sirius just listens patiently as Harry vents, much like what I do to you when right before we record, venting about my life.
What is that character that I am? Anne Elliot?
Yeah, Anne Elliot from Persuasion, yes.
That's fine. I don't mind at all. It's not that bad, everybody.
Now Hagrid's just shown me what's coming in the first task, and it's Dragon Series, and I'm a goner. And Sirius looks at him, and it's just funny because the first thing he says, like, dragons, we can deal with, Harry.
Yeah, he's like, let's just, whatever, let's get to the good stuff. Karkaroff was a Death Eater. And it's like, what? Wait a minute. Like, come on, let's pause and what?
So basically Sirius spills the tea that Karkaroff was a Death Eater. And the only reason he's not still in prison is he made a deal with the ministry and gave them lots of names and was an informant and, you know, basically threw a lot of people under the bus to save his own skin. And as a result, many people in Azkaban are not very happy with Karkaroff, and Sirius knows this.
Right. So he's kind of like, so it's curious why he's at Hogwarts, are part of this school, period.
And I'm just interested in the relationship between, you know, because Karkaroff was this Death Eater, clearly it must have been England to a certain extent, but I'm not sure about Karkaroff's background in terms of, did he actually go to Hogwarts? Is he, like, English of Slavic descent himself, or was he always, you know, affiliated with Durmstrang and became that headmaster because he went there? It's kind of unclear exactly, you know, how much Karkaroff is, you know, was a member of British society to the point that he was joining, that he joined the Death Eaters. But
it kind of confused me. I'm like, I know I'll know more eventually, but I did kind of wonder, like, What's he doing here? That's a pretty serious thing that he was. And I don't think that, like, oh, so let's let them around children. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, we've already heard from Hermione that Durmstrang already had this reputation of teaching, like, dark arts and focusing on that. So the fact that Karkaroff was a Death Eater and did all that shit wasn't take any points against him.
That was probably like a bonus on his CV.
Yeah, desired qualifications.
Right.
Which they never want to pay for.
No, they don't. No, they don't. No, they want you to have them, but they don't want you to pay. They don't want to pay you for them. Right.
Yep. So Harry's like, but are you saying Karkaroff put my name in the goblet? Because if he did, he's a really good actor. He seemed furious about it. He wanted to stop me from competing. We know he's a good actor, said Sirius, because he convinced the Ministry of Magic to set him free, didn't he? Now, I'd be keeping an eye on the Daily Prophet, Dan. You and the rest of the world, said Harry bitterly. And so Harry, so Sirius is contemplating or hypothesizing that Moody was brought to Hogwarts for a very specific reason. Not just Dumbledore needed someone to teach defense against the dark arts. Much like in my headcanon that I think Dumbledore specifically got Remus to teach defense against the dark arts in Harry's third year because he thought if anyone's going to protect the students against Sirius Black, it's going to be his old friend who knows how he thinks. And so likewise, right. I think, you know, Sirius is proposing that Dumbledore would have only put Moody in there if he needed a very experienced Auror to keep an eye on things.
Yeah, Moody, it's just even, it becomes more and more clear the reason Moody is there. He's there to deal with some interesting people.
With the intrigue.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And here we finally get a little bit of insight into Bertha Jorkins' character, like her personality. And Sirius is just like, she was at school with me. She was a few years above me, and she was an idiot.
Yeah,
she was dim, but she was very nosy, and that's not a good combination. I can easily see, as improbable as it seems, I think it's quite easy. It would have been quite easy to lure Bertha into a trap, which we know from the first chapter. We know that's what happened. That
right.
Wormtail lured her to Voldemort.
Right, exactly. And yeah, I'm glad they make the distinguish. You know, she was very nosy, but she didn't have any brains, and that was a really bad combination. And kind of thinking about that, it's like, oh yeah, that would be a recipe for disaster. So Harry kind of asks why Sirius thinks Karkaroff is there. And he said, I don't know. I just don't know. So that mystery, I guess, is...
Yeah, and Sirius, despite pointing the finger a lot at Karkaroff, it seems, Sirius is also, he's like, but on the other hand, Karkaroff is a coward, and I don't see him as the type to take his own initiative, like doing Death Eater shit, unless he knew that Voldemort was powerful enough to protect him.
Right. So I guess I'm just going to speculate. Karkaroff could be doing Voldemort's bidding, which means Voldemort's out there. But we don't know. I don't know. So we shall read on.
Yep. And so the dragons, said Sirius, there is a way, Harry. Don't be tempted to try a stunning spell. Dragons are strong and too powerfully magical to be knocked out by a single stunner. You need at least half a dozen wizards. But you can do it alone. There is a way, and a simple spell is all you need. Just, and of course, they're interrupted.
Of course. Of course.
Of course. And yes. What's the icing on the cake is not only is it anyone who interrupts them, but it's Ron.
Of course it's Ron. The person that's going to really get under Harry's skin the most at this point in time when he's about to get this very important information, the person that's under, you know, making him mad, walks in.
Yeah. And sorry about that, said Ron, his face reddening with anger. Should have realized you didn't want to be disturbed. I'll let you get on with preparing for your next interview in peace.
Calm down, Ron. Like, that, I guess I'm just not that. That was so aggressive. Like, yeah. They're so nasty.
Yeah. Harry seized one of the Potter Really Stinks badges off the table and chucked it as hard as he could across the room. It hit Ron on the forehead and bounced off. There you go, said Harry. Something for you to wear on Tuesday. You might even have a scar now if you're lucky. That's what you want, isn't it?
Drama queen. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Ron or Harry?
Harry. Both of them, really. But Harry's a little much.
Yeah, it's a little much, but honestly, I think the message sinks in, because Ron doesn't say anything, and he doesn't, like, follow Harry up to the dormitory, or at least not for a really long time. So I think by Harry specifically mentioning that, I think finally it cracks Ron's very thick skull of, oh yeah, my friend is famous, not like Victor Crumb because of Quidditch. My friend is famous for a really tragic situation. Right. All he was seeing was the rose tinted, all the attention Harry gets and things like that, not really thinking that, oh, this is like also a really shitty thing that happened to him.
Yeah, I mean, it helps to bring you back to earth, down to earth or something, because, you know, I don't know, just thinking about that different perspective when you're so much in your emotions as Ron is, it's helpful. So.
Yep. And that is why Ron is a Pisces.
He's a Pisces? Okay, that makes sense. I love Pisces. Okay, let's just put that out there, because I have most of the people I've known for my whole life are Pisces. But yeah,
they're so artistic and lovely.
And emotional. Yes.
Super emotional.
Yes. So. Yes. God bless them.
Yep. And then we get to chapter 20, the first task. And Harry fills Hermione in, and she's just like, let's try and keep you alive until Tuesday evening, she said desperately, and then we can worry about Karkaroff.
Right. So first things first, good for Hermione for, like, because I would be worrying about the thing that I should be worrying about later instead of the first thing, so good for her. Yeah,
especially because, you know, Sirius flat out said, like, this tournament would be a very easy way to hurt you and make it look like an accident.
Yes, and we're all kind of, some people have that realization toward the end of this chapter, which good that they do, but some other people are a little on top of it.
And so they head to the library doing some research. Dragons are extremely difficult to slay owing to the ancient magic, you know, and then Talon clipping by charm, treating scale rot. This is no good. This is for nutters like Hagrid who want to keep them healthy.
Oh my goodness.
Well, is Charlie a nutter?
No, Hermione Miss Judgy here. It's just judginess.
Well, I don't think that's Hermione. I think that's Harry.
Oh, that was Harry. Okay. Too much judge.
Hermione would not debase herself by calling Hagrid a nutter.
No.
Even if she may think it, she wouldn't say it.
Good. Smart. Very smart.
Yep.
And she's irritated with Crumb getting back on in the library, interrupting her little safe zone of study, because why doesn't he go read on the ship? But
And she's like, you know, she's just rambling on about various facts and it's like, I don't know about this or this, blah, blah, blah. Hermione, just shut up for a bit. And this actually kind of reminded me of I was with a group of like friends, like classmates in high school. We were preparing for our AP World History test. And there was one where I was just trying to, throw out some trivia to help people practice. And the one person's like, that won't be on the test. That won't be on the test. That won't be on the test. And I don't know how she knew that that wouldn't be on the test. But, like, it got to a point where I had to, like, I had to get up and walk away because I was going to say something really rude.
That's good that you got up and walked away instead of saying the rude thing. Sometimes I might not have that same filter. I don't know.
Yep. And so they skedaddle out of the library, and Harry is like, what am I going to do? And he realizes, honestly, I'd rather be here facing a dragon than back at the Dursleys.
I don't blame him. That was a miserable, miserable place. But good on him. This is where he's doing the, I guess, the Gryffindor thing. Maybe a little bit of a Hufflepuff.
Gryffindor and a Hufflepuff thing. So he deduces that at this point, Cedric's going to be the only one to face the dragons and not know what's coming. And he's like, that's not fair. And Harry at this point, he doesn't care about winning. He just wants to survive. Like,
right.
Like, he's just trying to, like, if he could take this on a pass-fail basis, he would.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, so he feels like, I think it's, he's doing the right thing, and I wonder if Cedric would do, I feel like Cedric would do the same thing. I feel like that's the reason. Like, I don't know about Victor Crumb or whatever, but it speaks to Harry's character.
Yeah, and even, again, you know, Harry could have been a little bitchy and be like, well, Cedric didn't believe me when I said I didn't put my name in the God of a Prior. I don't know. He can kick rocks. I don't owe him anything. But it, right. outside of this, like, crazy Goblet of Fire situation, he knew Cedric was fair and actually tried to call off and redo the match when Harry fell off because of the Dementors. And so, right. like, he knows Cedric in... At the very least, in a normal context, like, Cedric has a great deal of sportsmanship.
Right, yeah. And that's probably the... contributes to the reason that he decides to...
Again, which I love how Harry the writer weaved in the notion of Cedric in book three as just a very minor character and a minor detail, but it ends up being important in this book.
Right, yes,
exactly. Because Harry proves to have a more substantial, like, relationship with him.
Yeah, yeah, they think they have a, it's admirable, it's mature, so good for them.
Yep, and Cedric seems a little suspicious, but, and then Mad-Eye Moody catches Harry, and he's like, in my office now, and Harry's like, oh shit.
Right.
I don't want to be a ferret.
Right, yeah, I know, that was funny. Yeah, no, he thinks he's in trouble for kind of, like, revealing these secrets, because Harry doesn't know yet that, apparently cheating is part of the game, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah. What did you think about the description of Mad-Eye Moody's office?
Yeah, they kind of go through a couple of, you know, the other Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers and compare his office, which it didn't surprise me too much. He's basically got all these things to kind of handle different situations. So it wasn't anything, I didn't expect him to have, like, posters of himself on the walls a la Lockhart, but, you know, we got some little reminders of what was going on, or I'm sorry, magical items. And I thought it was kind of funny how he talked about his dark detectors and his secrecy sensor and all the things that were just constantly triggered because of the students lying and stuff like that, so...
Yeah. And to me, like, with all his, like, little trinkets, it kind of reminds me very much of how Harry describes Dumbledore's office with a bunch of cute little trinkets and weird astrolabes and all sorts of crazy shit.
Yeah. Yeah. It seemed like a very appropriate for him.
Mm-hmm. And so, found out about the dragons, have you? It's all right. Cheating's a traditional part of the Triwizard Tournament and always has been. I didn't cheat, said Harry Shardley. It was sort of an accident. I wasn't accusing you, laddie. I've been telling Dumbledore from the start. He can be as high-minded as he likes, but you can bet old Karkaroff and Maxime won't be. They'll have told their champions everything they can. They want to win. They want to beat Dumbledore. They'd like to prove he's only human.
Never gonna happen. interesting yeah, to me that yeah, cheating is part of it.
Yeah, you're going to take on the wizard who basically ended World War II.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of a silly thing. I don't know. Interesting that cheating is just kind of part of it. And I was trying to think, you know, I know we've talked about, like, the Olympics. I don't know if doping is necessarily, like, can just be like, oh, yeah, it's part of the Olympics. But I was trying to think of some, like, athletic event that was where it's kind of secret, you know, cheating is some sort of just agreed upon.
Yeah, thing. I've hasn't there been a few scandals of certain athletes having to, like, rescind their Olympic medals because they were, like, doping or doing, like, steroids or whatever crap?
Well, I was gonna say I just opened a can of worms because my husband and I come from a family of cyclists, so the Tour de France was riddled with doping scandals, and it wasn't like just Lance Armstrong. Everybody was doping. So that's why, like, if you look at some of the records of the Tour de France, they go back to, like, I don't know, the 40th or something participant, because it was just so common. So that's my only, but that was a short period in their history. I don't want to talk about the cyclist stuff because I will be very defensive.
It's interesting that you bring up the cyclist, because in the one of the, like, Canadian period dramas that I like to watch, Murdoch Mysteries, one of the mysteries about a guy who ends up dying, collapsing in a cycling race, he dies, and then through the investigation, the detective, basically the Canadian Sherlock, Detective Murdoch, he figures out that the coach was giving his cyclists an advantage by, you know, blood doping, basically taking their blood out and then putting it back in to give them that boost, you know? And the way the guy died is because they put in the, like, someone deliberately switched the types so that they couldn't accept each other's blood, and then one of the guys died.
Oh, wow. That's dark. But
yeah, it was very fascinating thinking about the notion of, like, blood doping in the early 20th century, and then just, you know, us just at the very beginning starting to understand that there were different blood types and all sorts of things.
Yeah, very interesting.
But anyway, you just made me think of that by thinking of cycling. But yeah, cheating, big part. I've never been so invested in something that I needed to cheat.
Yeah, it's not worth it. I mean, to me, I guess if my life was on the line, maybe I would. And I have to think about it from that perspective. From these folks, it's like, this game could kill you.
Yeah, and like, in terms of just looking like for like side hustles, like sort of tutoring things, if there's anything I could do on the side, I do on occasion, you know, see those sort of like websites, you know, for writing papers, and, you know, basically they portray it as kind of tutoring, but, you know, it's basically writing papers for wealthy kids who don't want to do it.
Wow, I had no idea that's what that was about.
There are some sites where I was looking into, it's like, oh, this might be interesting. Then I look at it and it's like, you know, pure, it became very obvious that I'm just like, oh, this is about basically making sure that some wealthy kid gets straight A's, but okay.
Ugh. Well.
Which, no thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, so.
Cheating aside, Moody is just like, well, I'm not going to tell you. But I am going to tell you, play to your strengths.
Right. It's like,
And so this level, do you think this is cheating technically on Moody's part? Because it's like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But is this genuinely?
I mean, I guess it's kind of like a letter in the spirit of the law kind of situation. And he's not saying like, okay, there are dragons and you should get this spell and blah, blah, blah. He's kind of giving him crumbs to kind of figure something out. But I don't know. I think Hagrid is more helping Harry cheat than.
Certainly Hagrid is more up there in the cheating than Moody is at this point.
Yeah.
And I really like that, you know, Harry pieces it together. And for the last few chapters, since he got at Hogwarts, Harry the writer has been dropping hints about the summoning charm.
I don't know if that's the thing I would have come up with, but good for Harry.
Yeah. And it's technically a really good way to overrule the stipulation of you can only use your wand.
Right. Yeah, because he can kind of manipulate that to get him what he wants, which I kind of was like, maybe that's, but I mean, that it's not like it's the rules seem to be very open-ended. It's like you have to perform this task and just solve the problem, doesn't matter how you get there, really.
Or at least I think the thing is, you start with your wand, and if you used your wand to get something, then more power to you.
Right.
Yeah. And so basically Harry spends all of his waking time practicing summoning charms, and he wanted to ditch divination, but Hermione refused point blank to skive off arithmancy.
Right. Yeah. Good for her. I couldn't skip class either, Hermione. Yeah. It's all good.
And Harry continues, and he finally masters it.
Good for him. Right in the nick of time.
Yep. And yeah, I'd been focusing on the summoning charm that even that evening that some of his blind panic had left him. It returned in full measure, however, on the following morning.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just trying to think, you know, facing a dragon.
I'm not Daenerys Targaryen or whatever. I wouldn't look forward to that, I don't think. I think it would be, I would want to see one. I don't know if I would want to try to get past one.
Yep. And it's very sweet. McGonagall escorts him to, like, the tent where all the champions are. And she puts her hand on his shoulder. And it's like, you know, it's totally fine. We'll be on standby if people need to step in. And just, poor McGonagall. She feels so bad for Harry. She doesn't let herself show it all that much. But she feels so bad.
she definitely is a maternal presence in Harry's life, which lacks a lot of that. But yeah, so this whole kind of bit leading up to the actual like event reminded me very much of the scene in the Hunger Games where they're about to enter the arena.
Right,
I was like,
Yeah, which is why I want to do that scholarly slither clause comparing Hunger Games with Triwizard Tournament at some point.
That makes sense. And kind of like, I mean, granted, I think when they're, before they get out there, they don't hear the noise. That's kind of like Colosseum, whatever, I would guess. But
yeah, like this, again, the spectacle of violence.
Yes, the spectacle of violence.
And just makes me think of, because, you know, we're getting close to Halloween, at least at the time of this recording, and just, you know, watching those documentaries and realizing just how much of rabble rousers people were during Halloween, like to the point of setting things on fire and smashing windows, like borderline riots. And literally the notion of trick-or-treating has existed in centuries, but they kind of brought it back, like specifically to try and bribe kids with candy. Please don't burn down my house.
Right. That's so wild.
So it's just the notion of like why are we doing this very dangerous tournament? Because there's something deeply ingrained in our, you know, evolutionary psyche that we need to have violence in some capacity. So it's better to have it in these very contained spheres under the guise of sport and spectacle than have complete anarchy.
Yeah. Yeah. Control the chaos a little bit, I guess, or the violent urges.
Yeah, which is why I get so scared, which I haven't watched, but that the Purge franchise, because I could totally envision something like that happening in a dystopian future.
Yes. I agree. I haven't watched either, and just not my bag. So.
Mm-hmm. So Ludo Bagman lays it out. It's like, your job is to get the golden egg, and the dragons will be guarding the egg with the rest of their eggs.
Right. So this is like, I mean, we're talking about, we're getting dragons at their most protective. So, hey, kids, let's throw a golden egg upon this thing that, you know, this nest of eggs that these mama dragons are like, do not touch this. So fun, good times.
Yep. And so is it Bagman or Crouch that has the bag of the bag of the little figurines? And of course, you know, you kind of already knew this, but yeah. So Cedric gets the Swedish snout, Fleur gets the Commonwealth screen, Victor Crumb gets the Chinese fireball, and Harry gets the Hungarian horntail.
Of course he does. Let's give him the most dangerous thing.
Always. And again, it's all about spectacle and stuff, because you would think, like, to be an even playing field, like, they should be giving them all the same breed of dragon.
Yeah, right, exactly. I thought that as well. It's like,
because again, like, I'm sure these species differ a lot behaviorally and, you know, in terms of their strength and weaknesses. Some may have bigger claws, some may have longer spines, you know. It just totally, I don't know. It should have been all the same breed.
Yeah, I'm guessing it's like dogs. It would be like a,
you know, in terms of world building, I appreciated it, but in terms of the actual rules of the game, I was just like, meh.
Yeah, right.
And so Harry, of course, has to go last. So it's like you're dreading the it's like I was sitting in the hallway waiting for everyone else to do their Arabic oral exam, and you have to wait and wait, and then finally you're like the last person. It's like, I want to get this over with.
Right, yeah, the anticipation is sometimes the worst, so.
Yep. And so Harry gets out there, and there was the horntail at the other end of the enclosure, crouched low over her clutch of eggs, her wings half furled, her evil yellow eyes upon him, a monstrous scaly black lizard, thrashing her spike tail, leaving yard-long gouge marks in the hard ground.
Sounds real friendly. Yeah, so he's, this does not look like just a cuddly dragon, but thankfully, his spell or his charm works to get his fireball. So that's good news.
Yes. And Harry feels like, oh, I can do this. This is just another opponent. And he's like, oh, dodging the fire is just like dodging a bludger.
And then we have our mini Quidditch here, or like
mini Quidditch, and you know, we don't have to go play by play. Long of the short of it is that Harry ultimately provokes the Horntail and antagonizes her long enough to where she finally takes her front legs and she rears on her hindquarters, and so therefore leaving the eggs exposed.
Which then he swoops down and gets the golden egg. It's not, I mean, I make it sound less dramatic and than it is, but it definitely, and he gets it rather quickly comparatively.
Yeah,
not unscathed though.
Not unscathed because he got a little mark from her, from the spiked tail in his shoulder. But yeah, Bagman's like, our youngest champion got his egg the quickest.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and McGonagall's like, that was excellent, Potter, cried Professor McGonagall as he got off the fireboat, which from her was extravagant praise. And Hagrid's like, you did it! And so everyone's so happy for him. And I love Madame Pomfrey, like, she knows she's treating everyone, and she's like, first Dementors, now dragons, what else are they gonna throw at this school?
Oh my gosh, yeah, we'll find out there, Miss Pomfrey.
Oh, and well, it's nice to hear one person, at least, even though she can heal them very quickly, at least she's making the complaint of, even if the kids can technically, as wizarding children, withstand this bodily harm, that doesn't mean we should make them.
Right, exactly. It's not, yeah, there is somebody that's not just sitting by and going like, oh, I mean, this is just the way it is. It's like, there's some, we're acknowledging the craziness, so.
Yeah, Madame Pomfrey does acknowledge the crazy.
Yes, yes.
This should be cray-cray.
Yes, exactly. Harry ties for first. So the scoring is a little questionable, I think. There's some favoritism there.
Of course, but before we get the scoring, Hermione comes in, and finally Ron comes sulking in with his tail between his legs.
It finally clicks for Ron. It's kind of sort of clicked the night before, you know, or when, you know, they had that encounter after talking to Sirius. But here I think it really gels. And he's like, what does he say? Oh, gosh. Harry, whoever put your name in that goblet, I reckon they were trying to do you in.
Caught on, have you? Said Harry coldly. Took you long enough. Harry knew Ron was about to apologize, and suddenly he found he didn't need to hear it.
And then Hermione bursts into tears and walks away because she's embarrassed of her emotions. Not so
like, you two are so stupid. Yeah, well, yeah, because I'm assuming Ron was able to put it together. Like, when you know, oh, like, glory, it's great. And then seeing the actual Hungarian Horntail and seeing Harry, and it's just like, okay, I know Harry has done stuff, but, like, he was being chased by the Acromantulas along with me. He does not thrive. He's not a, you know, an adrenaline junkie.
Right, right. It's good that he finally put it together, and it's good that he didn't, you know, it is, I think, so easy sometimes to just focus on all the, like, all the nice stuff when in disregard the hard stuff. So I'm glad they got over it and moved on, because I know Harry feels a lot better at this point.
Yep. And so, yeah, the scoring is Fleur is in last place, I think. And then it's Cedric. And then tied for first is Harry and Victor Crumb. And again, Karkaroff totally blatantly showing favoritism by having a 4.
Right. Yeah, that's a little bias.
Yeah.
Sir.
Yeah, because it's just comparatively, obviously, Dumbledore loves Harry, but, you know, sure. Crouch, who is an impartial, gave him a 9, and Maxime, of a competitive school, gave him an 8.
Yeah, this is all a big question mark for me. I guess it's kind of like the Olympic judges, and it's hard if their country is participating to not, like, be biased against your own country, but,
Yeah, that's the thing. Well, it should be, like, rotating where, like, if your country competes, like, you don't get a score. You get to have a score.
That would make better sense. Like, let's fly in some of these, you know, other countries. I guess then we're going to talk about they just bias need, and whatever. Or
just, well, again, it has to be an expert. I'm like, they should just fly in people who don't know shit like us because we won't care if the U.S. win or loses.
That I would be like that was impressive. Everything would be impressive. So I'd probably be the worst. But yeah, and
Ludo Bagman gives Harry a 10.
Not sure what his deal is quite yet, but I'm sure we'll get there.
So. And so last thing is Ludo Bagman explains to them that the golden egg, actually you get to keep it because that actually contains the clue for the next task and will give you a clue of what you need to do to prepare for it.
Right. Right. And then we kind of end the chapter with Rita Skeeter trying to stalk Harry and get a quote. And his quote is goodbye.
Yep. And he set off back to the castle with Ron. And thus ends the first task.
Beautiful.
I felt, you know, I know you said you felt a certain way about, like, oh, I really got into this series with the Unforgivable Curse chapter. Like, for me, it's like, oh, I'm getting into the real meat of it now by reading, getting through the first task. And now we're, like, really into it now.
There's a little, I did like how we explained, like, how the different players defeated the dragons, how Ron kind of gave the rundown. I thought that was good in that chapter. So we're about halfway now.
Yeah. In essence, what Crumb did with a sort of curse that to, like, you know, hit the dragon in the eyes, that's basically what Sirius was going to suggest.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Oh, they didn't mention that. Okay, I'm dumb. Don't worry. Sirius will mention it next chapter. Okay, I'm not spoiling anything. But
okay, I was like, I obviously missed something.
Okay, no, I'm just dumb and can't. You know, because I just finished my bloody Red Riding Hood cocktail.
No, you are fine, and that was not a giveaway.
Alrighty then. So shall we move on to Gothic Geek Out?
Yes.
Okay. So my Gothic Geek Out was, surprisingly, can't really explain why, Sirius in the Fire, the notion of Cladenstein, like, mysterious, secretive meetings. I feel like that's a big part of Gothic literature in terms of, I just finished The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. Took over 3 weeks because it's like 800 pages long.
Oh my gosh.
And, you know, there's several conversations that happened between a certain male and female characters, and everyone presumes that they were having an affair, and it actually, they were doing something bad, but it wasn't an affair. And so, but the guy let everyone think that because it was better to think that he was having an affair than what the real actual truth was. So just the notion of, like, secretive meetings, and of course, when the Gothic protagonist enters the haunted manor, she always ends up overhearing a, you know, pertinent conversation, scandalous conversation between the lord of the house or maybe some of the servants, or just, you know, secretive meetings.
Secretive meeting. That's a really good one. I think, I was going to ask you how The Woman in White was later. So good. We'll talk about it later, but that's a really good one. Mine was just the element of suspense. I know that's very kind of, it's not very, what is it going to say? It's not very solid or whatever. I also was entertaining the idea of Crumb as a Gothic hero.
Oh.
I don't know him that well yet, but he reminds me very much of Heathcliff for some reason.
Dark and brooding, because you know what happens with Hermione. Oh, that's a good one, because Harry mentions, like, Crumb seemed more, like, darker or surlier than usual, and he's like, that must be his way of expressing nerves.
Yes, yeah. It just, there were a couple things that made me think about him in that light. So those were my two things. I think a very, very loose way of interpreting a Gothic monster would be the dragons, but I feel like dragons are more prevalent in fantasy than they are really Gothic literature. I guess the calling, you know, Dracula, you know, the dragon or whatever, but I really I kind of was like, eh, that one was, I wasn't too sure about, so I'm going to go.
The only way it gets dragons into Gothic is because the dragons were so often depicted as, like, the manifestation of Satan and things like that, and just that sort of deal with gargoyles and the Gothic architecture and things like that. And more recently, of course, The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. She makes the dragons Gothic.
Yes, exactly. Very, with the little books. Yeah.
Yep. All right, then. But yeah, good stuff. And now we move on to Tarot of the Day, which I pulled out at random this time, was the Knight of Wands.
Okay.
So, the Knight of Wands shows the actual pursuit of the idea. When this card appears in a tarot reading, you are charged up with energy, passion, motivation, and enthusiasm, and you channel that energy through your inspired action. You have a clear vision about what you want to create, and fueled by your passion and inspiration, are now moving forward with leaps and bounds to turn your vision into reality. This card is your sign to go for it. So, when I think of this, I think of Harry, like, mastering the summoning charm to prep himself for the first task.
Yeah, that's a good interpretation, and just kind of going for it with the participating in the tournament. He doesn't really fight it, you know. He kind of is like, I didn't do this, but he's not like not trying to do it, whatever. He's participating.
Yeah, and you are bold and courageous and willing to venture into unknown territories to further your mission and your dreams. You don't really care if dangers lie ahead. In fact, if it does, then it becomes all the more exciting and thrilling for you. That's not totally true for Harry, and I think in terms of venturing into unknown territories, that makes me think of, like, Cedric, Crumb, and Fleur were hearing the rule you can only use your wand as quite literal. And so all of them resorted to various sorts of charms, you know, not the use of anything else to get past their dragon, like not sort of thinking, oh, what if I summon something with my wand? So Harry sort of thinking outside the box.
Good for him. That was very clever. And
Be mindful that the Knight of Wands can express himself as an act first, think later type of person, which I think is definitely Harry.
Yeah. Yeah, Hermione would be totally the opposite. So.
Yeah, she's the prepper.
Yeah.
Which is good because they all be dead.
Yeah.
All righty, then. Anything more with the Knight of Wands?
No, I think you did a good job covering it.
Okay, and then we move on to the Oracle card of the day. Let me just go grab the book. And so the Astrology Black Moon card that I picked at random for these chapters was the 11th house, like, which more or less equates friends. The 11th house is all about associations and how we connect to others. It is the house of group alliances, ideals, and our aspirations in a public or social arena. This 11th house is commonly referred to as the house of friends, but is so much more than that. It has everything to do with the collective that comes from groups, people who identify and align with each other to make social change. The 11th house has much to do with our destiny, what we decide to give before we leave this earth, our soul's purpose. 11th house deals with the greater good and living up to an ideal.
Living up to an ideal is interesting because I feel like Harry in particular can't be less than, you know. I think everybody's like, you survived, you know, an attack by Voldemort. So you kind of have to be, you know, kind of the best. Thankfully he is. I can't. imagine it being like, I mean, I like Neville, but like if Harry Potter was more kind of like a Neville Longbottom, that would probably be interesting.
So for me, given the emphasis of this house on friendships and associations and how we connect to others, that makes me think of, you know, the reconciliation between Harry and Ron and, you know, that sort of friendship. And then, of course, the friendship with Hermione in terms of, you know, working throughout the night and all day to help Harry. And speaking of friendships, it kind of makes me feel sad that Hermione, despite all of her, like, objectively better qualities, Harry doesn't like her as much as a friend as Ron because she's not fun enough, quote unquote.
Yeah, we were talking about some friends before this, and it's like, you know, you gotta have all kinds of friends for all kinds of reasons, not because they're the most fun.
So, that's what I think of. And also just not just the dynamic of old friendships and relationships, but the idea of creating sort of new budding friendships in Harry extending the olive branch to tell Cedric about the dragons.
Yeah, that's an interesting, because they're almost, I mean, obviously Cedric isn't Harry Potter. That is what it is. But you could see if Harry Potter wasn't Harry Potter, they're both very strong in their respective fields. You could see them getting along, kind of seeing each other as equals, and kind of nice.
Yep. And then the last thought I had was just, you know, relations with others, alliances, allies. Just the showing that for as crazy and kooky and wacky as Mad-Eye Moody is, he is proving to be a friend to Harry.
Absolutely. I think he's proving to be, like, an excellent... He kind of was a little unsure about him, you know, initially, and kind of he came with a reputation, but he's definitely doing right by Harry thus far.
Yeah. Alrighty then. Good stuff. And now we move on to our last exercise, fan fiction time.
All right.
So what was yours?
I had a couple. I know one of them. I don't know when this is. I know somebody's going to die. I know who's going to die. I know it's going to be in this book. I don't know if it's during the Triwizard Tournament. But my question was, what if one of the kids died right away? The repercussions there.
Well, if one of them died right away, I assume the Triwizard Tournament would be canceled.
Really? Okay. Because I was thinking historically they were talking about people die, and I didn't know what happened. Like, if somebody dies, is that like it's done? Or is it like, well, let's keep moving?
I'm assuming in the context of what they're trying to portray as being a sort of, you know, baby safe, baby proof Triwizard Tournament, that I think there would be overall consensus is that we're trying to veer away from its dangerous past. And so if someone died, then just it would immediately shut down. Because I don't see Dumbledore, even if he was the one to start all this, I don't see Dumbledore allowing the competition to continue.
Makes sense. Yeah, I guess, you know, I had a couple more, but I think the only one, what if Ron just still couldn't get over it? What if he was still mad at this point?
If Ron still was mad, especially in the context of Harry performed the best out of all of them.
Mm-hmm. Nothing changed, but Ron just still had these blinders on. He was still, you know, up in his feelings, upset with him. I think Harry's win would not have felt as sweet to Harry because he obviously sensed a great sense of relief.
I guess the question is would that be enough to just sever the friendship forever?
I don't know. I would hope not.
Because I just think I tend to feel like it kind of would. Because even again, regardless of the Triwizard Tournament, I think it would have just shown that Ron can't handle being a friend of a celebrity with his own insecurities. And there's always going to be something, you know, with Harry because he's fucking Harry Potter. So
right, exactly.
So if he still hadn't gone over it, I think, you know, even if Harry didn't know how to articulate in this way, at subconsciously he would think, okay, you know, I've got all this baggage of, you know, my fame, celebrity and stuff, and just clearly Ron can't handle it anymore.
Well, what about you?
Mine was, I was literally thinking of these at the last minute, like picking the cards at the last minute, but mine was just kind of funky. What if Harry had fought a different dragon?
Would it been a challenge? Or
I'm just curious of how much Harry's, you know, choosing his tactic of flying, how much of that was beneficial to him based on the certain temperament and behavior of the Hungarian Horntail, that he knows that it's very provocative and antagonistic and aggressive. So I'm just curious, like, would he, like, what if he got a different dragon and they weren't as easily provoked? And they just like, be like, oh, he's flying around. I don't care.
Right, just like chilling on the eggs, like whatever.
Yeah, I'm gonna take a nap.
Right. Interesting. Because you're exactly right. He was kind of provoking him by flying around her, and that got her riled, and so then he could figure that out. Interesting. I don't, because in my mind right now, like, there's a dragon sleeping on it, and they're just like, leave me alone. You know, nothing too intense. What else would he have done to kind of, I think he might have had to, like, to sneak into the little nest or something, and that would have been real tricky. He could have done that and then had his, like, fireball on the ready, so he could have jumped on.
Yeah. And it's just, I don't know if, you know, the size of the Hungarian horntail, you know, suggests that, that it wasn't going to get up and fly, regardless of the stupid crap they did and they wasted money on in the Goblet of Fire.
Yeah.
Like in the Goblet of Fire, there's this whole, like, chase sequence with Harry and the dragon, which does not happen in the books, obviously. And in itself, even for me, who, as much as I love dragons and usually enjoy any screen time with dragons, but for me, it pissed me off. It's like, you wasted so much money just so the dragon could have more screen time when you could have, you know, established, you know, necessary story points.
Man, I didn't know that.
But anyway, I digress. So I think of, it's kind of described with the Comish Welsh green as being smaller. So, like, what if the Welsh green just flew up after Harry?
Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, like, who was smaller and more able to coordinate and, like, you know, because they're more his size, and so he doesn't have the advantage, oh, I'm just a little fly.
Yeah. And was it Fleur that dealt with that one?
Yeah, it was Fleur who dealt with the Comish Welsh green, and she more or less kind of hypnotized her dragon.
Okay.
Just interesting. Can't really elaborate too much because we do not know the behavioral temperaments of any of the other dragons.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see it. I felt like it was a little sexist. Even though they pulled the dragons from the bag, that Fleur got the little one, but, you know, maybe there's nothing wrong with being little and fast.
That reminds me of, have you seen the franchise How to Train Your Dragon?
I have not.
Well, there's this point where they're training with the dragons, and there's one of them that's really tiny, just as the size of a cat, and one of the Viking teenagers is laughing, hi, he's the size of mine, and the little dragon immediately goes for his face.
Well, there you go. Small but mighty. Yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about, just to see if that was how, just kind of mixed that up, how that would have played out.
But yeah, that doesn't really change anything grand scheme of things. I just wonder because I'm crazy about dragons.
Yeah, that's all right.
Alrighty then. And thus concludes this episode of Rambling Raven Puffs. Tune in next time for chapters 21 and 22, The House Elf Liberation Front and The Unexpected Task. And joining us next week will be my sister, Holly Jensen, who we haven't heard from her since Chamber of Secrets. So it'll be fun to have her again.
Yeah, very cool.
Alrighty then. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.